Now, this is an interview with Lieutenant General R. What's your middle name?
J.
R. J. Lane. And Dr. Ari Troy, with the assistance of Christopher Main, my student. Now, Reg, let's start, as I say, with your very early life. And I should say at the very beginning that I hope this is one of about four. I think you're going to be at least a four, if not more. So, if you have the time...
I'm at your disposal in that respect.
Okay.
Time is no problem.
Well, you were born... If you want to start from there.
Yeah, okay. Born here in Victoria.
Yeah.
January 4th, 1920. Went to, grew up in Victoria and really had not left Victoria until the war, except for the odd trip to Vancouver, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I suppose I had never been off the island. But in those days, in the 20s, when I was growing up, going to school, became very involved with the cathedral, Christchurch Cathedral, with the choir, and then with the scouts. The cathedral in those days had a boys' choir, a large boys' choir. We had almost 30 voices in the choir in those days, boys. So we formed a scout troop alongside the choir, and it had been the hope of the choir master at that time and the bishop that there would be a choir school associated with the cathedral, but it never got off the ground. The hall, which the memorial hall, which still is behind the cathedral, was to have been the actual school itself. But unfortunately, it never really got going. The cathedral ran out of money. As you know, the cathedral still isn't finished. The main tower is still yet to be built. The foundations are there, and the cathedral was designed to join right up with the memorial hall, and it would just be one great big block-long building. Yeah. However, that didn't come off, which was a shame. However, the association with the choir, we had a choir master by the name of Bully, Stanley Bully, who was the organist, and he was a real martinet. My God, he was. We had choir practices Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday afternoons after school, Friday night with the full choir, that's with the men and the women, Saturday morning, and of course two services on Sunday, matins and evensong. So, and the choir practices were an hour to an hour and a quarter every day. Well, of course, as a result, the choir was a very, very good choir. And every time I hear what's going on as they are and have just finished, I always think back to that, because of course the cathedral choir was entered into every one of the choir, as a choir, and used to always walk away with the trophies. But it was great training. As I say, Bully was a martinet. He was tough taskmaster, and he brought the choir along, and as a disciplinarian, that was where I guess I got my first real bellyful of discipline. My God, he was tough. And we used to be paid a nickel a week. A nickel a week was what you got, until he became the head choir boy. And when he became the head choir boy, I think he got 10 cents a week. But if you were late, or if you did something which Bully didn't like, for example, it wasn't unusual on a Friday night for one of the younger choir boys to fall asleep. Literally, fall asleep, say by 9 o'clock or something like this, because the choir practice each one's left now. And with that, Stanley Bully would fine you 5 cents.
Good Lord.
And he kept a ledger, so of course you lost your week's pay by doing something which he didn't like. So, as a result, the discipline in the nickel was amazing. And I can remember that as a result of the... And also, of course, you never saw the money, it was banked. It literally was kept in an account until you left the choir, then you were given a check which was all that you had in your account, minus fines.
Oh, my word.
And I was in the choir for years and years and years and years, and I had enough money to buy a new bike when I got out of the choir, seriously enough, because of course it had gained interest and all that sort of nonsense. But it was that much. However, that was one... That discipline, that training, I suppose, in certain respects, was a good foundling, because I started about the age of, I suppose I joined the choir when I was about seven. And I didn't leave the choir, I suppose, until I was about 14, when my voice had broken. And of course, by that time I was head soloist, all that sort of nonsense. But mm-hmm. And you start singing one of those anthems and with a solo in it, and then all of a sudden your voice would crack. And of course, Bully would frown from the organ and say, well, I guess the time has come. And out you went.
Well, but why this intense interest in the choir? Was your father a minister?
No, negative. No, mother and dad were both choir people. Were both fairly strong church people. Mother was very involved with things like the Mother's Union and the Women's Auxiliary and that sort of thing. Dad wasn't so much, but mother was. And my earliest recollection of church, actually, is going into the old cathedral, the wooden cathedral, mm-hmm. which was on the site of the justice buildings or the courts. I can remember going in there, and then I can remember Dad taking me down when the cathedral went up in smoke. By that time, of course, the new cathedral was well under construction. Not finished, but well underway. And a good friend of the family was the electrical contractor, Langdon. They're still in town here. They were doing all the electrical work in the cathedral. And so every once in a while, Mr. Langdon and Dad would go down and we'd go through. And they dragged me along, he dragged me along. And we'd just walk through the new cathedral under construction. But I remember going down to see the remains of the old cathedral, and of course that then put the pressure on to get the new cathedral finished. And I can't remember the gap in there, but I think there was a very short one. So the cathedral really was opened and consecrated well before it was finished. It was a rush job.
Well, what did your father do, Reg?
Oh, Dad was a civil servant. Dad worked down at the in the dockyard. Mm-hmm. Dad had an interesting life. I didn't know this until much later on. Dad and my grandfather did not get along well in England. Dad was with the government in London. Actually, he was with the Weights and Measures outfit in those days. I gather that they were pretty tough on Weights and Measures. I never realized it, but apparently they were. Anyway. So Dad finally, I guess, came to a parting of the way with my grandfather, and he left to come out to Canada when he was just about 17. He left, literally left home, just got up and left home, came out here. Went out of the prairies, and I had his diaries. Dad was a great diary person, and I had his diaries right back to about 1909, I guess it is. And his diary entries of the prairies, the life on the prairies in those days, farm life, it's pretty atrocious. It makes you realize just how tough things really were. If you saw that film, Don't Shoot the Teacher, I don't know if you saw that film, but it's incredibly good. And it's about a prairie school teacher and the trials and tribulations of teaching on the prairies in those very early days when the land was divided. There was that section which was set aside for the school, and then the school was stuck right in the middle of the section of land, and there was nothing around it.
Yeah.
In some cases, not even an outhouse.
Yeah.
And that film is obviously a fairly honest attempt to portray life on the prairies in those days.
Well, how old would he be when he came out?
Dad was 17 when he came to Canada.
I'm sorry, I should say, what year?
Oh, Dad came out in 1912.
1912,
yep.
Was he in the, did he join up during the Great War?
Yep, well, what happened was, then he came to the prairies. Life on the prairies was so tough that even the people that he was with at that time decided to leave the prairies and come out to the coast. Mm-hmm. And they were very great frontier people, by the name of Hopkins. And again, a branch of that family is still here in Victoria. But Hopkins went up the west coast. Up just above Tofino, Vargas Island, as a matter of fact, is where they went. And so Dad came along, and laid a claim, a land claim, on near Catface Mountain, which is just north of Tofino, mm-hmm. on Vargas Island. And began to, was more prospecting, because he did find copper on the property, not in any great quantities, but it was there. And he scratched a living by working with the Tofino, doing a little bit of prospecting, fishing, that sort of thing, as still as a very, very young man, of course. But then the war came along. So, of course, Dad joined up and joined up here in Victoria.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I'll have to check that out. One of the battalions, and I can't, right now I can't remember. Yeah. I still have the badges and so forth.
Yeah.
Stuff at home.
Wouldn't be the Canadian Scottish.
No. It was something like the 56th. I don't know which one it was, but I'd have to, one of the battalions.
Right.
And operated, of course, out of the willows and so forth. And now, Dad didn't actually join until 1915, I suppose it was, because he talks about the big, he did talk about the great big snowstorm here in about that time, when they had something like 6 feet of snow, and they pulled the troops out to clear the streetcar tracks and so forth. So Dad went overseas and managed to survive the war.
You know what corps he was in? Was it infantry?
No, I think he was a sapper. Dad was a sapper.
I see.
Yeah, he was a sapper. And again, he kept a diary right through the war, so his entries are all in there, you know. Some very caustic remarks about some gallantry awards handed out. It doesn't mean anything to me, but at least, or the names don't mean anything, but a couple of very caustic remarks about they actually weren't there when it happened. And then, of course, on leaves, went back to London, and had known my mother and her family in London before actually coming out to Canada, curiously enough. So that when the association was renewed during the war, immediately after the war, in 18, mother and dad were married, and then came back out here to Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
So mother came here in, early 1919 as a very young bride, right from London. But then Dad, had to find a job now, because, of course, married now, and he didn't want to go back up the coast, and Mother didn't want to go back up the coast. Mm-hmm. And it's most unfortunate, because, of course, he didn't pay any taxes on that land, and it reverted back to the Crown. I wish to hell he'd kept it. I'd like to have had that piece of property up there right now, because it's just part of that National Rim area, so you're getting up into that area, that park area, and so forth, and it probably would be worth a little bit. Now, anyway, however, that's gone.
Yeah.
Well, Dad then was with the dockyard and stayed with the dockyard right through the Depression, right up until he retired. And when did Dad retire? I guess Dad must have retired in the 50s, I guess it would be. Probably about the late 50s. Because once I left Victoria, my trips back here were very, very infrequent, and they were very short visits too. More likely a weekend, until we started to have children, and then the odd time we came out and we were here for a week or so. But really, I almost severed relations with Victoria once the war started.
Well,
and if it hadn't been for my mother and father and sister, I don't know whether I probably would never have come back, but I had a sister as well. So aside from, the attraction was to come back and see mother and dad and my sister.
Yeah.
And then mother died. Mother died about 62. And if you're going to go, I suppose it's the way to go. She was out in the garden picking flowers for the house. She was always a great gardener, had a lovely garden.
Yeah.
Both mom and dad loved the garden. They had a lovely garden. And she just keeled over with a massive brain hemorrhage, and of course never survived, and never came around, and so that was it.
Yeah.
Then Dad stayed, of course, here in Victoria, and then Dad died while we were in Europe, and it was most unfortunate because I couldn't get back for his funeral. Dad died in 66, and my sister tried desperately to get through to me, but she didn't know how. And she tried to phone me, but we were in France, and phone connections in France were then and still are almost impossible. And she finally wound up sending a telegram, which got to me about 4 days after Dad had died. So I had no knowledge of what had happened. And of course, by that time, she said, I've tried desperately to get in touch with you. And she didn't think of going through the service, which was the unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
And I never did chide her over that, of course, because she felt bad enough. And if she'd just gone through the service, if she'd just called any of the Squamish or anywhere, they would have, of course, immediately got a signal through to me, which was the way to do it.
Yeah.
However, So Dad died, and with that, then of course I only have my sister here. So of course my association with Victoria is becoming further and further and further away, and not knowing whether or how whether I'd ever come back or not.
Well, did he, in the 20s or 30s, was he ever attached to any militia unit?
No. Dad had the army right up to...
quite difficult.
Right up to the years. He had very much reached the point where he just felt that any further association he just didn't want. Although, a little later, of course, as he began to reflect back, he joined the Legion, where a lot of his friends were. Yeah. And he retained that association right up until the time he died. But that was more memory stuff than active participation.
Well, I suppose you too, during the period, during the 20s and during the 30s, that you weren't connected with any...
No, I was too young.
Yeah.
I was too young. Because born in 1920, and with school. Yeah. I didn't finish school until, 37, I suppose. High school, 37.
What school did you go to?
Vic High. And... So having not finished school and then of course still right in the throes of the Depression, I debated, or at least Dad and I had a long chat about me going to university, and it was a simple matter that he couldn't afford to send me to university.
Yeah.
And I had, if I wanted to go to university, I had to go get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I should have also mentioned, though, I want to go back to those choir days before we get on to that post-school area. The other thing that was terribly important in those days, as far as my early days are concerned, was that scout troop became an extremely good one under Major Jim Wise, who was, now here's a Canadian Scottish man.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually Black Watch in the First World War,
mm-hmm.
and ran or had an insurance business here in Victoria in the 20s. And 30s, and a bachelor, and he lived in the Union Club. He had a room, and that was his home.
Yeah.
But he was a great outdoor man, and which was a wonderful thing for that troop, because every weekend, most weekends and most Saturdays, he would load the car up with kids, and we'd go up the Souk River or up the Cowichan River and go fishing, fly fishing and this sort of thing, or just literally go camping.
Yeah.
Great man. Just a great, great, great person. And now, again, another bit of a martinet, but in a very nice way. Not a hard-nosed man like Stanley Bully was, but a very, very fine person. And he, and it was more than just scouting. It was outdoor life, camping, discipline in an easier way, but nevertheless discipline, because he used to have a bark like a sergeant major when he wanted to use it. But a very open-hearted person, and he used to spend a lot of his own money, because he was not hard up. He was fairly well off. He also at that time had an interest in the gang ranch up in the interior of BC, the gang ranch.
Yeah. Wow.
So he used to go up there. He would disappear for about a month every year, and it would be sort of his combined holiday and business when he would go up to the gang ranch. But the association of those two men, Stanley Bully and Jim Wise, and Jim Wise died during the war. I'm just going to leap ahead a wee bit. I came back in 1943 for couple of weeks, and we can get into that a little later, but I came back to Victoria and immediately called Jim Wise, and he said, we've got a scout meeting, which was Wednesday night, but normally the night they met. Would I come down? And I said, yes, I would, of course. And a lot of the younger lads in the troop, of course, were then the patrol leaders, one was the troop leader. So he asked me if I would take the salute and say a few words. And he then began to speak about me, because by that time I had the DSO and the DSC, and I was a squadron leader, and so of course I was a bit of a novelty here in Victoria. But he was an old soldier, And boy, he spoke. It was just terrific. It was just magnificent. So I felt even, I had even a greater respect for that man after that than I had before. It was mm-hmm. very, very high. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time I saw him. He died about a year to 18 months later, so I never saw him again. And I had hoped that I would, because he was such a fine person. Russell Kerr, mm-hmm. for example, yesterday, or at least on Monday, Russell Kerr, of course, knew Jim Wise very well. Well, he was very well known to the people yeah. who were in Victoria in business, in insurance yeah. business, particularly yeah. in those days. And all for the greatest respect and esteem. Never married, don't know why. Well, those, as I say, those two people had a great influence on me when I was growing up, because I spent a hell of a lot of time with both men
yeah.
every week, year in and year out, over many, many years. And then somebody else who became associated with, and I had not to the same extent, but I became a bell ringer, a campanologist, as a result of coming up through the choir and becoming a server and working with Dean Quainton, who was another tough man. Dean Quainton had was a very stern man. My goodness, his sermons on Sunday nights when, on the English Union were just something to behold. He'd go on for 45 minutes, and the choir boys were allowed to take books in, novels in to read, because they, of course, his stuff was a plain where there's just no way that even then, all of a sudden there'd be a crash of a book falling, because of course one of the choir had fallen asleep, you see, listening to the Dean Quainton drone on. But he used to fill the cathedral. My yes, goodness, that evensong, he'd, during the summertime, too, he would fill that cathedral, and people would just flock into here. Bishop Schofield died. I remember Bishop Schofield. The bells, he was the person who got the bells into the cathedral, Bishop Schofield. He was the one who went to England and raised the money to have the bells cast yeah. in England yeah. and so forth. Yeah. And also got the money to finish the tower, because the tower at that time was the North Tower. It really only went up just above the porch doors, mm-hmm. the big porch, oak porch doors. So it probably wouldn't have been more than perhaps, 25 or maybe outside 30 feet of the tower. Mm-hmm. And so that tower had to be finished before, or at least up to where the belfry was, before yeah. Before the bells could be hung. So he raised the money, not only to get the tower built, but also the money for the bells themselves.
And this during the Depression?
And this, this would be, I guess it would be, yes, because, of course, you're right. We were in the middle of the Depression. Absolutely yeah. right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Because I was a server when the bells were hung, and then Arthur's father,
mm-hmm.
of course, agreed or took on the task, because he had been a bell ringer in England. He took on the task of forming a bell ringing group.
Mm-hmm.
And he somehow, I don't know how, but managed to bring together a group of people who had been bell ringers in England. Before long, there was the whole peal of eight. There was about, I suppose, it must have been 12 or 13, 14 bell ringers. And he wanted to get some younger people in, so he got Arthur Izard and Margaret, Arthur, the daughter. She became a bell ringer, and I got roped in, and I became a bell ringer. And it was, we used to enjoy it. So I by that time, I had given up being a server and became a bell ringer, because it was meant being in the belfry, of course, right up till the last minute before service began. And it was a morning and evening, and there was bell ringing before both services.
Mm.
And in those days, we even tried to ring a peal a couple of times, but it was never very successful, because we just weren't good enough to know what to do it.
Yeah, that's and, quite an art, I
guess. Oh, yes, it is. A peal on the bells the size of the cathedral, which is their duplicate of Westminster Abbey bells. The peal, it takes about 4 to 4.5 hours to ring a peal of grand sire triples. And you know, the theory of bell ringing is that the sequence of the ringing of the bells is never duplicated. That's why you get, yes. It works out to something like 5,000 No, I'm sorry, it's not 4 hours for... No, that's a peel of eight. It takes about 2.5 hours to ring a peel of eight. But you go through something like nearly 6,000 changes, and the trick is to know the changes which take place mathematically so that you do not repeat a sequence in the same order.
Right.
And so it takes... It's like anything else of that nature.
Yeah.
It takes concentration.
Yeah.
Great concentration. The leader... has to what they, he is just like the maestro running an orchestra of eight instruments, and his chore is like reading music. He has to, in his mind, know when there are changes, and a change is when you get the third bell always the sort of the key bell, and it really moved, and everything else moved around it, so to speak. So you never get the same sequence, and the trouble was, looking back, the one chap who was the sort of the maestro, he was very good. You could see his lips moving. He was just calling out every damn line of the sort of nearly 5,000 changes as it was going. But gosh, he'd just lose his concentration. One bell would just get a little bit out of timing, which of course was important, and he'd lose his concentration. And of course, once he lost his concentration, the conductor had lost his place on the music, you see, so it was game over. And we never did rig a field. Never. Never did.
What about sports, that sort of thing?
Well, the sports came, of course, at high school. I played rugger. And then I became very interested in basketball, and I played for the Y. You used to get on the Y. For swimming and so forth, as well as to the as well as to the Crystal Gardens, but the Y was great. And Archie MacKinnon, of course, who's still in town. I saw Archie MacKinnon just the other day when I spoke to the Rotary. Archie was, of course, a young man in those days and very keen. And I started to play basketball for the Y,
mm-hmm.
and I did that for a few years. I guess I did that right up until the time I started to work. Yeah, thank you very much. Until I started to work, and then I don't know why I stopped. I guess I began to chase girls, I suppose, something like that. Anyway, there was a far more interesting sport came along. I know that. But the I did played rugger at Boys Central, and initially at UVic, but I was never heavy. I never was big. Relatively in size to some other people. So as I got into high school, I just wasn't big enough for the rugger team, so I never did make the team. But basketball was a different story. And I used to love basketball.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I suppose, one of the reasons why I enjoyed it so much and became quite a good basketball player was that down in the Memorial Hall, which is where we used to have the choir practices, there was a very good gym in that mm-hmm. Memorial Hall. And I would go after choir practice, I would go into the gym and put in about half an hour or 45 minutes, depending on how much time I had. And Saturday morning, after the Saturday morning choir practice, I'd go and I'd put an hour in the gym. And maybe somebody else would come with me. But just sit there and take pot shots and shoot away and shoot away and shoot away and dribble, dribble, dribble. And all just literally ball handling.
It all added up.
You're darn right. After two or three years of that, you get to be a reasonable ball handler.
Well, so far, what you've said doesn't add up to a great fighter in the sky sort of thing. You know, maybe there's something between 37 and 39.
No, I don't know. No, I don't suppose so. I suppose, I don't know, service life is, I think, as much as anything else, is a matter of discipline. And of course, leadership. As a result of my choir experience, becoming the choir leader, head choir boy, choir leader, I became the head of the servers in the cathedral. And, of course, I didn't become head of the bell ringers, but in the scouts, I became a patrol leader, then I became the scout leader. And then Jim Wise asked me if I'd take over the troop. And so the last 2 years before the war, I actually was the scout master. So I was actually running the troop and taking the troop to camp in the summertime. We'd go up the Super River. We had a lovely spot in the Super River. God, it'd be just magnificent. And I believe firmly that military life is really made up of the two things. One is leadership, and the other is discipline. And I don't mean... There are many forms of discipline. Yeah. There are many forms of leadership. There are those who will get behind and prod. There are those who will coerce with language. And there are those who will just get quietly out in front and do the bloody job, and everybody just comes right along behind. And so I was always, I suppose, a believer in that third form. I was never one who was... I never liked to drive people. I had too much of it from Bully and a couple of others. It just rubbed me the wrong way. On the other hand, when you became a troop leader, you took those kids up to camp and you were responsible for them, you had to provide a leadership and you had to get those kids to come along.
Yeah.
You couldn't beat them because, Christ, they'd break up crying the first thing you know, and then they'd be screaming for their mother, and you'd have to somehow or other get them back into town. It was bad enough with homesickness as it was. So it became, the leadership became really a form of leading in a fairly, by example and by gentle persuasion rather than hard coercion.
A little bit like what they call militant Christianity, or what have you.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
And so with all that background, when the war did come along, I had joined the Hudson's Bay Company by that time and getting a job. I almost went into the bank. A good friend of mine who now in Vancouver, we both went to the bank because we thought banking would be the answer. And I took one look at it and said, God, I don't know. I don't know that I could stand that kind of indoor life at all, being behind the bars and so forth, and being a teller and all that nonsense stuff. I said no. And at the same time, I had gone to the Hudson's Bay Company to see if I could get a job in there, literally as a stockroom boy, in order to get started. Well, my friend got into the bank, Bank of Commerce, and I got into the Bay. And he is still with the Bank of Commerce and is in the head office in Vancouver and probably will be retiring in a year now. But I went to the Bay, and I was told that if I wanted to come in and to learn the merchandising business, I would have to start right at in the stock room, which is where they put me. And we had a woman, I can't for the life of me remember her name. She was the personnel manager of the Bay. And years and years later, as a matter of fact, in the little Hornets recent years, it suddenly dawned on me that gal was probably one of the originators of the real business management. And we're now going back to, 37. She would run two nights a week. She ran lectures for about four of us who were all the same age, all stockroom boys, various departments. And she ran what were straight business management courses for us two nights a week. And we did that for about 2 years. And it was the Bay's way of in-house training, on-the-job training, so to speak, of preparation for managerial positions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'll never forget, my first bloody paycheck was $5. It was $5 a week.
Yeah.
Was the pay scale.
Yeah.
Of course, it went up fairly rapidly, but by rapidly, I mean sort of at a dollar a time. And it soon reached the glorious rate of $12.50, I guess it was. $12.50 a week. And then by that time, I was actually selling. I was not just a stockroom boy anymore. I was actually selling. But it was indicative of the depression.
Yeah.
What it was like.
You're still living at home.
Still living at home. Yes, I was still living at home. Because, I was still only, 18 and or 19.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, of course, and then 39 came along, and I was 19 then, and the war started. And like, I suppose, all the others, I wanted to join up. And the question was, what to join up? What to do? Dad had always wanted me to join the Navy. Or in the back of his mind, I think, Dad, because he'd been associated with the dockyard and the Navy, Dad always wanted me to, in the back of his mind, I think he always wanted me to join the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And for some unknown reason, he had an engine room artificer in his mind. And that, although, I'll never forget that phrase, because Dad used to say, I was lucky to become an engine room artificer, and I never knew what the hell it was. And it wasn't until much later that I realized what it was. I said, thank God I never did join the Navy and become an engine room artificer. I don't know what. No explanation for it. But the Navy never did appeal to me. The Army, I had immediately joined the non-permanent Army militia immediately the war came along, because that at least got me into a militia organization.
Which one?
I went into the ambulance corps, because with all my training in scouts and so forth, and instructing in first aid and what have you, I thought, well, the best thing I could do is join the ambulance corps. But I had already made up my mind, of course, to go to the Air Force, and I had put my applications in, and this was as much as anything else, a stopgap until I found out whether I was going to accept it or not. And it was just where I could help, because I was an instructor in first aid, and therefore, with all the youngsters coming in and the need for instruction in the militia, I could make a contribution there. Well, I applied, and I can't remember when I applied. It must have been probably about the end of 39, or certainly early 1940. Because I had my first medical. I had to go to Vancouver for my first medical, and I always remember it, the 24th of May. An easy day to remember, and also it was a holiday. And it was easy, therefore, for me to get away from the bay, to get over to Vancouver to have a medical and not lose time at work. Because in those days, you just didn't take time off. If you did, you were...
Yeah, you lost
pay. Yeah. And I had that medical, and gosh, another thing too. As a youngster, I suffered terribly from migraine headaches, and I mean serious migraine headaches, violent migraine headaches, to the point where they would literally immobilize me. I'd even at the Hudson's Bay, people who suffer from migraines know when they're going to come on. And it starts with your vision begins to go. You get black spots and so forth, and that brings on vertigo, and of course, so there's bilious and violent headaches, terrible headaches. Well, when those would happen, they hit quickly, and I mean quickly, so like in about 10 or 15 minutes. And quite often, the manager would literally drive me home in his car, because that was the only way I could get home, was be taken home. And I'd just go, mother and dad, they knew there was nothing I could do, and I'd just go into my room and pull the no light, and I'd just stay there until that goddamn thing passed. And it would take normally about 12 to 18 hours for the darn thing to work its way out. Well, and these were violent. Well, of course, when I took my first... No, it wasn't my first medical. I passed my first medical, which was more of a screening medical. And then they said, okay, go home. We'll call you. We can't take you at the moment because there's just the pipe is plugged.
Yeah.
Go home. So I did, and then I was called, and it must have been somewhere around August, for another medical. Mm-hmm. And this time, of course, it was a very thorough medical. And the doc asked about things like headaches and so forth, and did I have headaches? And I said, yeah, I have headaches. He said, how bad are they? I said, oh, you know. Geez, if I'd realized that what I was doing, I probably wouldn't have lied as smoothly as I did, but... I said, no, they're all right. They can get pretty bad, but the word migraine never did come up in the discussion. And when the medical was finished, the doc said, well, he said, yeah, I'm going to pass you. But he said, boy, if those headaches were any worse than you said they were, I wouldn't have passed you. You're an air crew medical. So I thought, okay, that's fine. And that was it. Well, again, to kill that thing, you know, all through the war, I had migraines during the war. But I never had a migraine at a moment when it was important in any way. They either occurred when we were not operating or when I was on leave or something. Never once did I have a migraine when there was an operational overtone or operational connotation at all. In no way. Not even near them. I mean, it was incredible. Incredible. Absolutely.
Yeah. You still have them?
Yes. Yeah. But they're mild now. Well, they're just like nothing more than a headache. You can differentiate between a headache and a migraine, because a migraine starts with this little bit of trouble with vision, which passes off in about 20 minutes. But by that time, of course, you've got a headache.
Yeah.
No, now they're. I just take a couple of aspirin, and that takes care of it. But no, in those days, oh, they were violent.
Oh.
And well, you don't people who suffer from migraine.
I know.
Some people. I was lucky.
Yeah.
Mine would pass in, say, 18 hours maximum. Some people have migraines, and they'll go on for 48 hours. And I feel for those people. Oh, dear me, I really do. They're terrible things.
So it'd be 1940 before your call to the coroner.
Then I was called. I'd passed that medical, so then... No, still going, thanks. So I was... September... What the hell did I do? I joined September 25th, I guess. September 25th, I signed on the dotted line in 1940. And that was it. Off to pilot training, went to Brandon.
Well, now let that slow up just for a moment. Yep. By that time, just as an aside, had the RCF base out at Patricia Bay started up?
You know, I don't know.
No.
I don't know. I think we'd have to look in the book to see.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
But you would have
nothing
to do
with that.
So,
because everything was done in Vancouver. Yeah. I had to go to Vancouver for medical.
Yeah.
There was nothing here in Victoria that I can remember. I don't think they even... I can't even remember if they had a recruiting office. I can't remember where I actually went to apply to join up. I suppose it must have been in Victoria. They must have had a recruiting office here. They must have been. But the medical was done in Vancouver, and I had to go to Vancouver sort of to do the final signing and so forth. So there was, couldn't have been anything here.
Where would you be, first of all, where would you get your uniform to start out with?
I didn't get that until I got to Brandon.
Brandon was the first training station you went to.
That's right, yeah.
And that would be part of the British Commonwealth Air Training
Plan?
That
is right, yes, because by 1940, the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan was beginning to get off the ground.
Yeah.
But only just getting off the ground.
Yeah.
So, I don't think there was anything here.
What I'm trying to think of, Reg, would you go there in civilian clothes?
Yes, absolutely. Went right to, in civilian clothes, right to Brandon on the train.
Anybody else that you knew?
No.
Any of your buddies?
No, we were, our movement, I just was with a gang from when we left Vancouver and didn't know a soul.
Yeah.
We were just and no one knew anybody. We were all strangers.
Yeah.
In that particular draft,
yeah.
It was a full trainload. We went to Brandon.
Now, what was it like, you know, when you get off the train at Brandon, shall we say, and thinking in terms of somebody 50 or 10 listening to him? What?
Oh,
you get off
God,
the plane and what? Off the train. You get on this platform. And what happens at that point, shall we say?
No, thanks very much. Well, of course, remember I said I had never been off the island except to go to Vancouver, and once I went to Seattle. So as far as I was concerned, this was a great adventure.
Yeah.
And Dad having talked about the prairies so much, and how much he hated the prairies, I think I knew what to expect when it came to going, finally getting on the prairies. I don't remember going through the Rockies. Perhaps we went through the Rockies at nighttime, because I don't remember it. I'm sure I wouldn't for the first time going through the Rockies. I don't remember it. But I sure remember those prairies. And then that long ride across the prairies and then finally getting off at Brandon. And Brandon, to me, just looked like a hick town, which is really what it was. A two-bit prairie town. I can't remember what the population of Brandon was, but I don't think it was more than about 15,000.
That's
a pretty small place.
Yeah.
And, of course, I suppose the reason why they picked Brandon for the initial training school, and I forget the number, 3ITS or something like that, was because it had the great cattle buildings, barns and so forth, the exhibition grounds which were for the whole area. And that was the ITS.
Ah, I see.
They took over the great big, the main exhibition hall was the drill hall. All the barns were rapidly converted into massive bedrooms, dormitories.
Yeah.
I suppose we were sleeping, we were all in double-deckers, and they were awfully close to each other, and I suppose we must have had close to 1,000 men in that in the one big room. That was a great experience because, of course, the snorers were just terrible. And I remember the one who slept above me, God, snoring. It was unbelievable. That was where I first learned the art of how you teach somebody not to snore, by just getting a
small ball of carbolic soap, tiny little ball, and stuck it in their cheek, in their open mouth, you see, just put it in the side. And of course they realize there's something wrong, and they start to chew, and of course stuff. Then they begin to froth at the mouth. And then they wake up, and the taste of carbolic soap is something frightful. And the language then gets pretty severe, but my God, it stops them from snoring, I can tell you, because they're always frightened. If they get their mouth open, that's what's going to happen.
Did you ever have any of the jokers in a room like that have the other one, too, you know, after everybody's asleep, to start dripping water in a pan to send everybody off to the urinal?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. No, we never tried that one. No, we never did that one.
That's a favorite Army one.
Yeah. But then in Brandon, that was where we got our uniform and greatcoat. Now as you were getting into the late fall, getting into the fall.
Yeah. Now you'd be an AC-2.
AC-2. That's right.
Second class.
With an R number. Can't remember what my number, but the numbers began with R when you were in pilot in aircrew training. R something. Everybody, it was all aircrew. Everybody was—they were all going in for aircrew training.
But nevertheless, the first thing you'd have to do is some basic
training. Oh yes, that initial training school. We were there for golly, how long would it have been there? 4 weeks. And it was straight up square bashing.
Yeah.
Inoculations, getting all the inoculations. Again, further medicals. Equipment. I can't remember what lectures we had. We did have lectures, and I guess they must have been the usual service code of discipline, QR, that sort of stuff.
Map reading, don't
remember map reading. No, I can't remember anything that was really associated with the operational side. It seemed to be all administrative in that sense. I can't remember.
Would you have any arms drill?
Yes, we had arms drill.
Yeah.
Yes,
right. Rangers?
Yes, we did a little shooting. And a lot of route marches.
Yeah.
They had to route march you to get people out of the bloody way. Literally, there were so many people in that complex. we weren't sleeping in warm beds, but it wasn't far removed from that. Mm-hmm. And the messing facilities were just strained to the limit. The drill indoor facilities were strained to the limit. And so the only way to get out was to take people out for route marches.
Mm-hmm.
And God, you'd go out in the morning and not come back until 1 o'clock, and by that time you'd probably covered 10 or 12 miles.
Yeah.
And in that way they got you out of the bloody way. A part of the thing too was, again, the pipeline was still jammed, and it was as much of them holding.
Yeah.
So hell, what can you do with people? You gotta do something with them. So route marches.
Yeah.
Boy, I remember blisters, we'll try to break boots in.